You also need to keep in mind that usually data teams are the most exhausted teams.
For
They
sure.
usually have, let's say,
Yeah.
25 balls in the air, and they constantly juggle them. So then when it came to them, oh, let's help to define the use case, usually they don't have time because if they just stop firefighting, you know, the whole thing's just go down. So here it's also a question of prioritizing versus what we're gonna try, with whom we're gonna try. Who will be available for this execution? It's like a trade-off. If we want to try to do this, then who will be available for that? Because if you say, oh, we have only one, I don't know, like data solution architect, if you pull this person, then the rest of the teams, like for really mission critical stuff, have to wait like month, it's not gonna fly.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to add this because sometimes people, again, so excited, they do all these plans, and then when they get in back to the moment, oh, who's going to execute this? Apparently it's only one data team which doing everything.
Yeah.
So here I would say, probably getting back a bit to the question, what miss about mistakes, I guess the biggest of the mistakes is also forgetting about prioritization and prioritization of the resources, prioritization of time, of what we want to achieve, and let's say how it's going to cost us, like in time and other type of value, basically.
Hello, and welcome to Coffee with Coalesce, a monthly podcast about all things data and the trends and technology transforming our industry. I'm Armand Petrosian, CEO of Coalesce, and here with me is my co-founder and CTO, Satish Jayanthi. Together, we'll be your host for the next hour.
Wow, Alex really just went for it. No warning. at least we let's give it a second. It usually takes a little bit for people to jump in on LinkedIn Live, but we can get rolling. I'm really excited about today's event. This is another Coffee with Coalesce. For anybody that's new here, I always enjoy seeing who is calling in or who's dialing in and from where. So if you can hit the comments and mention where you are tuning in from, we always have a global audience. I think today we've got a global presence as well, which is awesome. We've got a very special guest, one that I'm uniquely excited for, Una. And where are you calling in from, Una? I didn't even get to ask you that backstage.
Amsterdam, the Netherlands.
One of my top five favorite cities in the world by far. Did you grow up there, or how did
no,
you end up?
I relocated to the Netherlands 10 years ago.
Amazing. That's cool.
Yeah.
I love it. And then I got my co-founder and other co-host here, Satish. I'll let you quickly introduce yourself before we make Una the star of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Una. Nice to, you know, have you on the show. My name is Satish Jayanthi. I'm co-founder, CTO of Coalesce. I'm, you know, super excited to talk about the topic today, which is, you know, a pretty popular topic these days, data mesh.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. For anybody that doesn't know me by now, my name is Armand, CEO, co-founder of Coalesce as well. We're your co-hosts. Una, you are the guest. You are the star of the show. I've got a ton of questions for you. Before we jump into anything around data mesh, could you just give the audience and both Satish and I a quick background on who you are, how you ended up in this industry, and also how you became a thought leader on data mesh?
Oh, I wouldn't call myself a thought leader. Come on. I would say I worked with it. I've done some stuff.
Now that you're on Coffee with Coalesce, you are an official thought leader.
Okay. I will try to keep it short, basically. So if I look back, it's like almost 18 years now. And I was going from the more like analytics data backgrounds, then to product development, then to having my own company, selling the product, then getting back from, let's say, more managerial stuff back to development, and then spending decent amount of years working with AI and data, and where basically the idea was, okay, we don't keep up with the current development of the markets. We don't keep up with the development of our customer needs. So let's do something about that, how we could quantify it somehow. So in this case, yeah, you can call it, it was and data mesh and data warehousing and like a lot of things. Yeah. And now after doing last 8 years, mostly hands-on consulting work, different levels, I would say, operational, you know, tactical, even strategical when it's needed, like to support you, for example, with the development of AI strategy or data strategy to make sure that it's not, you know, like 100 pages document set in stone and it will be valid for 10 years, but more like something fluid with some sense of direction. Mm-hmm. And a couple of months ago, I decided to get back to the founder shoes and open my company. Awesome. So now I'm officially like, yeah, founder again.
Congrats. We're all crazy.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So one thing I'm curious about, and, you know, from my experience, I felt like, and you somewhat insinuated this a little bit earlier, but there are so many terms at this point for data, like data warehouse, data lake house, data fabric, you know, blah, 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 data mesh. And I'm not going to lie, when I first heard the term data mesh, I was like, do we really need another one of these? And so I'm curious how you, or when you, if you remember when you first encountered that term and what that experience was like.
Oh yeah, I remember it's like pretty good. So by default, I'm kind of a bookworm. So of course I have a subscription, O'Reilly subscription to read O'Reilly books, early release books, also get access to Manning books, separate Manning subscription. So you again can read early release books. And I was at that moment busy with some kind of MLOps project, which were involving some migration from on-prem to some hybrid model and setting up the way how the data scientists would, and let's say the DevOps folks, can work together to deploy things. And of course, it was pretty straightforward, but the huge caveat was access to the data. Right. And it's not about data during the training, but it's also data for evaluation. It's also data for constant monitoring of the specific algorithms. And then when I tried to map the data flow for this specific use case, it was like hilarious. So to get this tiny amount of data points available here to do the job, it costs tremendous amount of time, efforts, and different teams to deliver this here. And I was just wondering, could we do it somehow better? Mm-hmm. Is this something more efficient? And then I was just basically scanning the books, what's are there, what could we get. And I came across like early release book. I was just curious what it's all about. I've noticed like there was some chapter available and I started reading it. Mm-hmm. And then for me, what was really nice, it was and reading it at the same time as the book is on the point of being written and at the same time trying to implement it.
Right.
And what was really nice is like, you know, to distill this really, I would say, vague still concept to something that you can implement. So yeah, that was my first time basically when I came across it.
So you're basically consuming that document while in real time trying to implement a data mesh. So that must have been a blast and also chaotic.
Yeah. I get the hardest part is to get buy-in from enterprise architects, to get yep. buy-in from it was a huge enterprise, so they have separate solution architects for different departments. So basically to implement one simple workflow,
yeah,
it's gonna cost me like I guess 10 people to talk to.
Yeah, that's not uncommon in enterprise companies at all for any type of change, especially one that's that new. It is interesting how times have changed, though. I feel like, you know, we were at Snowflake Summit in June, and there's tons of different executive level conversations I had with CIOs and chief data officers. And nearly every one of them brought up data mesh. They may have not said, there's the cat with a guest appearance. nearly every one of them, like maybe they did, maybe they weren't forthcoming about saying data mesh themselves. But as they were describing what they want their enterprise architecture to look like and the methodology and how they wanted to approach data projects, I would say like, oh yeah, like data mesh. And they'd say, yeah, exactly. Just like that. And so, you know, time changes. I think we saw a similar type of community get built with Data Vault. If you're familiar with that, I'm sure you are out in Europe. It's like a pretty common implementation methodology. But data mesh, it's a bit more broad, I would say. Like you could build a data vault in data mesh. Again, going back to the terms I was talking about earlier about data lake, data lakehouse, data warehouse. Anyways, what do you think is, like, when you think about executives and how they approach data and consuming data, like, why do you think it is that data mesh has resonated so much with upper management recently, or at least in the last couple of years? Why has it taken off?
Yeah, I need 1 minute because now the guest cat wanted to go out and start scratching the door. Just give me 1 second and I get back to you.
I don't think we've ever had that before. The guest cat interrupted the Coffee with Colette.
Interrupted the show, yeah. Yeah, this is the first time.
Yeah.
I guess we, for the benefit of our audience, we should also have Una define what data mesh is. You know, a lot of people think about data mesh. Is it a technology? Is it a paradigm shift? Is it, what is it? You know,
that's a good point. Maybe that's a good point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Una, we got 2 questions. You left, so we came up with more.
Wow. Okay.
Hopefully the cat's okay. So maybe before we jump into why you think executives or upper management have, like, data mesh has really resonated with them, can you help define the term for the audience? Because I'm sure there is a lot of people tuning in who have varying opinions of it. And it would be amazing if we could distill that in today's Coffee with Colas.
Yeah. First, for me, data mesh is a framework.
Okay.
It's not a step-by-step instructions, what to do, how to do, if you make a step right or left, it's right or wrong. It's not about that. And you mentioned, Data Vault 2.0, and all other. It could be a part of it. It could be a part of the mesh where, for example, for some specific, let's say, aggregated products, data products, it could be used. But getting back to the data mesh, for me, this is the way, like the completely new way to approach data, and make sure that the data are purposeful, the data are qualitative enough, and there are specific definitions of what do we mean by the quality. And it's not just, let's say, for me, it's a new approach because let's think about the data product as a like standalone container. So if it could somehow go to this like quantum piece or part of it, then it's like standalone thing that do the job good. And if you set up it properly, it helps you to deliver business value.
Right.
And then the way how this separate entities could be part of this, let's say, network, let's put it this way, and how we could basically orchestrate all of it, that for me personally, this more like the essence of data mesh.
Okay.
Because if you look at it from the perspective of just like architecture, of course, we can start talking separately about storage, you know, infra and all of that. Then if we, for example, talking about cloud, okay, we go to a specific combination of managed services. Is managed service a data mesh? Not. But a combination of it, let's say, backed up by specific rules, definitions, that's what you get. So probably really, really long explanation. But if I try to simplify it, basically a standalone way to encapsulate the data that you're using for specific purposes, which has a clear purpose, why it's done. And there is a traceable way to, let's say that it delivers value.
Okay.
So if I put it this way.
So you say it's basically an accessible data project that has traceability as to how the answers or how the data got to the point that it's at, and also can clearly define the value that it delivers.
Yeah, and it also comes with the whole audit trail, as you mentioned. Right. Indeed, right. That if it's not like accessible by everyone, if you have permission to access it, you get access to it.
Right.
And then, for example, let's say if we have something with very sensitive data, but after processing the sensitive data is removed, that there are also specific permission traceability back, basically what happens with these data points and how they were, done.
Right. So, some level of access governance for who's consuming it, who's interacting with it, who's changing it as well.
But what I would add here, for me, it was a big game changer with the whole concept of this federated data governance, because in the majority of the cases, if you look from the perspective of enterprise, data governance team is like a police team. It's like no one could go through. And it's not about that. It's about completely opposite. It's to make things available, something that it's allowed to be available, and the rest that has to stay hidden, keep it hidden.
Yep.
And you give this opportunity to do that. So it's like it's a completely new paradigm, let's say, change, because it's not this one thing that rules them all.
Right. Okay, I've got more questions. It looks like the chat is finally working on LinkedIn. We've got Crandon on LinkedIn. Hey, Brandon, what's up, man? Welcome. Hope you enjoy the show. Anybody else, if you didn't hear the beginning, let us know where you're tuning in from, what city you're in, what country you're in. I'm personally in San Francisco along with Satish right now, but Una's in Amsterdam. So let us know. And if you got any questions for Una while we're going, feel free to hit the comment section. It's always best that people can actually engage with our guests themselves. So, Una, you just defined data mesh for everybody. Super helpful. I'm curious now, back to my original question, why was that so something that resonates so strongly with leadership teams? Because, I'm talking to not just CIOs, chief data officers, but even CFOs. There's people like other people in the C-suite in general, and they're attracted to this concept. So what is it that you think leads to that? What's the allure? Okay. By the way, we've got a lot more people commenting now. We got Drake, Colorado with Craig, London for Steven, not England though. Canada, apparently. Chicago, okay. Nick Niemeyer. Hey, Nick, Amanda from Houston. And we got some questions coming in. Keep it rolling, everybody. Anyways, Una, back to you. So how would you, what is it? What is the allure for execs right now with data mesh?
I would say it's half-half. It depends on the markets. I would generalize stuff right now. Like it's really huge and big generalization. But unfortunately, in majority of the cases, especially data and AI part, Europe is way behind, let's say, the United States market.
Right.
When I'm saying this, I used to work both there and there. So I would say where the American market is more about pragmatism, right? Okay, what I get for my buck? So if I just put it in here, so what I get? Okay, right. I want the data mesh. Could you implement it like in 2 days? No, why not? So it just go and buy a tool. Oh, it's not one tool. Why it's not one tool? And then, the conversation unfolds, basically. Why I need like 25 subscriptions? What's going on here? From another side, there are so many resources were already poured into this tremendous data migration. Right. Each of them were promising now the data would be accessible. Now the quality of the data would be great. And every time we basically firefighting the same fire again and again and again.
Right.
So I would say if we could prove that this is a wonderful possibility to turn from the, let's say, to make your data team or your data department or like data departments, not a cost center anymore, but a profit center, and somehow link the work they're executing to the business outcomes of that. And if you can visualize it and make it like clear, let's say crystal clear, mm-hmm. that could be the catch. So basically then you can say, okay, let's just remember this Pareto rule. Probably 20% of the data flows we are using are the most important one. That's where we're going to put a focus. Right. And the 80% is just trash, you know? But does it's really, really, really important to do something with this trash right now, or it can wait? So that was more, let's say, the conversation that I sensed more or less on this North Atlantic market, for example. In Europe, it's slightly, also, again, Netherlands is different from Germany, different from Belgium.
They're all subcultures. Yep.
Of course. Here, the story is slightly different. Here is more like, give me 10 years plan of how it will be implemented. Let's define the data capabilities and tools right now. Yeah. Doesn't matter that the tool's gonna change, you know? So the catch is that we flip the coin and going from just cost center being like data teams being constantly cost center to becoming like part, like, or at least part of them becoming like a profit center. Plus it's also data that you can trust.
Yeah.
And it's also, if you're in a highly regulated industry, then it's about huge penalties if something goes south.
Right.
So it's more or less, you have this nice, crisp and clean defined things properly documented. You have this audit trail. So in case something happens, we can, you know, show everything that happens. And that's what become more or less at least catch for the data governance folks here mm-hmm. and let's say other folks. But there are some people who are really, really against that.
Right.
And, you know, when they were following the Gartner, like the magic quadrant, when it was there, then it was a specific moment, it was not here. So they're like, oh, it's not there anymore. So we're not going to do this anymore. And then when it's pop up again, there's like, something happening.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, anytime companies make decisions based off Gartner, I always question their decision making. I guess it's a safe decision. By the way, it looks like we've got people from all over the world at this point. Hey, Jeff, over in Boise, we've got Portugal with Alberto, Barcelona, Monica, South Africa, Claudius, so many others. But there is a question from the audience. And then Satish, I'll pass it over to you for anything you're curious about. But Marcos Kerpel is asking, what type of organization needs to be set up to create a product using data mesh? I think it's an interesting question because you could ask, you know, is there a size of company that's more suitable for data mesh? Is it better for an enterprise? Should a startup do it? You know, what is the actual breakdown of the structure of the company need to look like for a data mesh to be successful?
I would turn it a bit around. I would not focus on the size of the company. I would focus on what are you trying to solve?
Mm-hmm.
How many, let's say, potential, let's say, departments, parts, whatever you have, and is the way how we're going to use and consume data is pretty much straightforward, then probably you don't need data mesh at all. Then, you know, if you have different departments, the data flow to a specific place, aggregated, and then it's consumed from there, you don't need data mesh probably. You know, you have right now DBT. With DBT, you can solve like all the SQL transformations, you can test them. It would be nice, you know, or like the Snowflake story, like there is a way to do it. But in case when you have really, let's say the use cases when I would say it's many to many, that could be an interesting option. One thing I would say, from my personal experience, I was spending more time working with enterprises. It's usually a completely different story from the startups.
Mm-hmm.
But in my practice, I also saw one startup, they were starting without data mesh. Then they realized that the way how they're growing, they couldn't catch up with, let's say, the data needs that they have. So in this case, they decided to try it out.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I would say if I try to summarize, it's not about the size of the company. It's about more or less like the core data flows that you have. So many to many, for me personally, in my opinion, was like the best solution for its usage. But it also could be that not the whole company adapt data mesh. It also could be a story when there is, let's say, more, let's say, like old school part, which will be still okay in their specific, let's say, the way how they use and consume data, like in batches with like refreshment, I don't like once per day, probably they would be okay there. But then if you have different tiny, let's say, entities that require data from each other, then to have something at the end, then probably you can invest in it. So that would be, let's say, my answer. And in addition to that, I usually do recommend, if you want to start it, of course, try with some, you know, like baby use case first, just right, to see how much time everything is needed, mm-hmm, and then continue. Because also based, like, do we have a platform team that support all other, your, let's say, data and AI workflows or not? If not, then there are a lot of questions that have to be decided in the future. Mm-hmm. But basically, if it's the company that doesn't have any, let's say, the multidisciplinary teams, mm-hmm, then it's probably would be, or not the way to go at all, or really, really long way to go there, versus, let's say, the new company that has this, you know, like fluency and fluidity to jump from one like part to another one, backed by some platform services in the background, or just like, let's not call it platform services, and like some 5 or 6 DevOps folks that can support with any request for resources, for example, then it would be a different story.
Yeah, I do agree that, you know, if you've got one consolidated project, then it kind of defeats the purpose of implementing a data mesh. But if you've got numerous teams in different departments that all are trying to access data, and they're trying to add on their own last mile effort or their own permutation of the data from the foundation of what's been built, then the use case, like then the benefits start to really shine. And so that makes a lot of sense. Satish, anything you're curious about for Una?
First of all, I think she covered a lot of ground here. So some of the questions that I had, you already addressed them. But there's one question regarding governance. Now, you mentioned, you know, governance teams are like police. It's hard. I have experienced those, you know, that, you know, personally, and when I was working for some other companies in the past. So the federated governance, you know, what does that mean? And how would one approach that? You know, if let's say they have decided to do data mesh, and they say part of this is federated governance. So, you know, generally speaking, you're kind of doing this governance not at one place, but you're letting the, you know, domains do the governance. What has been your experience, and how would one go about implementing that?
Yeah, I guess it's also like the question that was like the whole 1 hour discussion. So, of course, in this case, we can look at different types of governance setup that the company has. But let's say there are some specific basic rules that has to be executed, and then you can have very specific rules which are created for separate domains. For example, you can have 5 domains that they do not process any sensitive data, let's say. Their government's, let's say, requirements would be a way different than the domain that works with this type of specific data, for example. So let's say, happy path, you want to have one place, at least where you can have a list of what you have in-house with some specific rules that you have there. And then how it would be executed, then it's magic, let's say. And the way how you're going to set up this magic, it's again based on the combination of tools that you're going to use. But the main idea is that, remember we were talking about this like tiny, like the box, let's say, for where we try to encapsulate our data. So this is a way from programmatical way to execute just, let's say, access or deny, let's say, rights here. And then we have this possibility to set up specific rules, the global rules, and then trying to see which rules gonna make sense to execute them programmatically, which rules could be automated, and which rules could be kept still, let's say, which require some specific control, like human in the loop. And then what are you gonna do? So if you go with the standard setup, then you will have this specific, let's say, global, and then they'll say specific like local rules that could be overruled. And then there would be also the way how we're going to set up it programmatically or not. And then we're going to see basically what we're going to do to move forward with that. But to say again, it's still really, really like vague and fuzzy, if I put it in this way. So the idea is that from one side, you still have one place with specific rules. From another part, you have like small entities capable of connecting to that, checking, doing specific validations, and then help you to create a specific, let's say, reports on top of it, or specific like gatekeeping mechanism or something like that. But the idea is that if you need access for a specific data, it's not that you're gonna go to the tool, look up in the tool, whom to contact to. But in your case, you go into, okay, based on who I am, which rights do I have, I'm gonna access to this specific list of things, probably gonna get specific snippets of what's there. And then if it's like pretty sensitive or something, then there are a list of people whom I can contact to get access to. Or you have, you know, even like magic button where you can click and request access to this specific data set. So that's more or less, let's say, that's what we want to get at the end. The thing is why it's, from one side, what I describe in sounds still like really not federated and just, you know, one place that rules them all. But at the same time, that's, let's say, the magic of the whole concept, where you still have global things, which then, let's say, push down to their like really, really low level when they can be implemented. And then they can basically like fetch back something to the global level. So it's more like that.
One other question I have, these, you know, domain teams, you know, it looks like they need to have certain experience and certain skill set, right? I mean, to make all of this happen. I mean, you just don't go implement data mesh just because this is a new buzzword and you're excited about this and you read a book and you start, you know, thinking that you're going to implement this. So my question is, what are the minimum kind of skill sets that a domain team should have? What's the team composition looks like? Hey, here's, I need a couple of data engineers. Of course, this all depends upon the size of the company and all of that. But what are the minimum kind of requirements there?
I would say I would separate it from the, let's say, the permanent members and like temporary members, or let's call them like consultants or helpers or something like that. So usually when you start something like that, of course, I would want to have at least one person. Probably the company just have only one data governance person, probably more. But in this case, I would still have the conversation with them, security team as well, because especially if it's about specific sensitive data, then data privacy experts, if the company has. But it's more, let's say, on like, you know, like the team, it's not a core team that driving the efforts, but they're here to be consulted, they're here to be asked for specific advice, and then they are here also to test it out, to try it out. So if you look at the team, let's say 1-2 data engineer basically of the size of the project, then I would say sometimes it could be, I'm talking now not about the amount of people, I'm talking about the role, and keep in mind that one person could fulfill 1, 2, or 3 roles as well. Mm-hmm. For sure, like DevOps person to support there. If it's related to AI, it could be, you know, the data analyst, data scientist. There is also a new term which was coined some time ago, like analytics engineers, basically the data engineers who are mostly working with SQL. I would say that's it for now, just to start. And also like the person who I would say oversees the developments, you can call it, I don't know, like project, product, or whatever it is for now, then you will, you know, you will learn who it will be. I will start like that.
Okay, cool. So is it, bit of a broad team, or at least like different roles and titles. You know, is there anything you've seen be common pitfalls or issues that people run into when they're trying to implement a data mesh?
So the hardest part is usually the first one. So when you do the first trial. So the idea is then by building it from, let's say, from the first like or second attempt, you're going to see which specific potential workflows or the model of consumption or something could be repetitive. Mm-hmm. If it's repetitive, it could be templated.
Yeah,
if it could be templated, it would become a backbone of, let's say, of the blueprint, for example, for a data product. So the thing what I saw, let's say, some type of extreme parts of it. So I saw option when the people were so, you know, engaged and so excited to execute that, they'd all go through and then they ended up with having like 8 teams fighting about what should go and don't go into the specific templates.
Yeah, I see.
So if you have similar situations, then, you know, you have to learn to talk to each other for sure. And there was another extreme when basically it was, let's say, everything was so versatile. It was almost impossible to encapsulate what can get potentially into the template because all the use cases are very, very different. So that could be the challenge. And another thing which I would also say, especially for really technical teams, sometimes folks that just get so excited to try it out, to build and go forward, they completely forgetting about why we're building it in the first place.
Yeah.
So what I do not recommend too is to start implementation of data mesh without having 0 real use cases. So either no real use case, which where you can try to map data flows and then to see what it would be like the added value if you go this way, then I would say it would be just, you know, playing around, just do some spikes and then basically like stopping it. And this is usually a really, really neglected part because sometimes the folks are just, you know, so excited. Oh, cool. Look, how I did this. Oh, now I can harvest metadata. Cool. Look, now it's great list. Bam. Now you can go there. You see it. Wow. Cool. And now you can just click on the button and get access. That's fantastic. But we are not creating data product factory.
Right.
We just constantly ship different, let's say, templates. We are creating the bare minimum, which is needed to spin up new data products. But at the same time, we want to make sure that the work we're doing is meaningful. So this, like, if you want to go without platform team, you can go still, but you expect to have at least some templates that you can then reuse.
Right.
That's the point.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting unifying theme with all of our guests on this show, which is people always bring it back to what is the actual value of the project in the first place? And if you don't know that answer, then you should be concerned. So for anybody listening, and you're a data engineer or you're a data engineering manager, or you're working on an implementation, analytics implementation, or data mesh, I think at any point you should be able to determine why you're building what you're building and what the actual value is that's being intended to deliver. Because, you know, sometimes these projects don't deliver what the intention was necessarily, but it does lead to something else that is valuable to the business or is a valuable insight for somebody who's trying to make a decision on strategy or something along those lines.
You know, one thing that just was on the tip of my tongue, you also need to keep in mind that usually data teams are the most exhausted teams.
For sure.
They usually have, let's say, 25 balls in the air and they constantly juggle them. So then when it came to them, oh, let's help to define the use case, usually they don't have time because if they just stop firefighting, you know, the whole thing's just go down. So here it's also a question of prioritizing versus what we're going to try, with whom we're going to try, who will be available for this execution. It's like a trade-off. If we want to try to do this, then who will be available for that? Because if you say, oh, we have only one, I don't know, like data solution architect, if you pull this person, then The rest of the teams, like for really mission critical stuff, have to wait like months. It's not going to fly.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to add this because sometimes people, again, so excited, they do all these plans. And then when they get in back to the moment, oh, who's going to execute this? Apparently, it's only one data team which doing everything. Yeah. So here, I would say, so probably getting back a bit to the question about mistakes, I guess the biggest of the mistakes is also forgetting about prioritization and prioritization of the resources, prioritization of time, of what we want to achieve, and let's say how it's going to cost us like in time and other type of failure, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a constant battle, I think, now more than ever, as companies have to be more economical and they're trying to save costs in every different direction. It's just a part of every discussion, whether it's on the platform, whether it's on the operational expenses. And so priorities are important. Data teams are always swamped. I mean, there's never ending list of requirements. I'm curious. I think we got time for a couple last questions, Una. So one thing I'm curious about is, you know, we always do like these predictions for the following year that's upcoming, and how the data landscape is going to change. And so from your perspective, as we approach, you know, the fall and winter and think about 2025, what do you think will be the difference in the data landscape? Anything notable that comes to mind when you think about 2025? And is it an optimistic or is it a pessimistic perspective as well?
I would say for me, it's, you know, it's like half-half. It's half pessimistic, half optimistic.
Yeah.
I will start with pessimistic ones, if I may.
Okay, yeah, let's go.
So I would say for pessimistic, there would be a lot of lessons learned, a lot of hype will pass through, and there would be, you know, like the consequences the data teams again will face. Yep. So, which means that especially companies, you know, who play around with, oh, we're going to replace our search engine with LLMs. Right. Sure, yes. Let's take a look at the cost and the rest of the stuff. So from this part, I would say pessimistic in the sense of that a lot of companies realize that their data engineering capabilities are not enough, mm-hmm. and they need to expand if they want to execute, let's say, what was in their planning.
Yeah.
Optimistic that I still see a lot of simplification coming up. Yeah. For example, like a big game changer was like when Databricks implemented, announced, let's say, the implementation when you can basically use natural language when doing specific data transformations, mm-hmm. which is really, really powerful. Mm-hmm. So I would say it would make it easier if it would make it from one side more accessible, mm-hmm. but not for everyone. So it depends on the size of the company, depends on the topic you try to, you know, to conquer, depends on the things you're trying to do. So for sure, there would be a huge progress in this part as well.
Right.
But at the same time, I still see this like downgrade when there will be a lot of eyes opening because the budgets for GenAI would be exhausted. Yeah. The real production results would be minimal. I'm not saying for everyone. I mean, for specific. And then comes the question, why are we getting what we're getting? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because we made like wrong investments, unfortunately.
Yeah. So it sounds like you feel like companies have overspent on generative AI ambitions and are probably going to have a rude awakening in 2025 as to whether or not those implementations or projects actually led to anything valuable. I was going to ask on your perspective of AI in general. I think you kind of answered it, but do you feel like it's more hype than it is helpful at this point? Do you think people have taken it too far?
Again, you know, it's like kind of a slider. So there are use cases which were impossible before.
Yeah.
You can unlock them with that. And that's the way to do it. But there are a lot of use cases. It's basically the story of nail and a hammer, right? So if you're just going to try to apply it blindly everywhere, before, you know, we have the rules before. Start with rule-based. Rule-based not working, go with statistics. Statistical approach not working, go with simple like linear regression, logistic regression, depends. If no, then you go with neural network, and then you go. So I guess approach it the same way. Like do we really need this? From another part, the way that a lot of models are right now offered as a service, basically make the bar, they lower the bar drastically for a lot of companies to try it out. So the company could have zero data scientists or data engineers, and they still can do something with Gen AI because they can just, you know, the developers can just call the API and they get results, and that's it. So I would say for the use cases where it's needed and for the use cases to be unlocked, that's a fantastic opportunity. From another side, we have this overhyped story with like question mark on how much it's going to really cost.
Right.
Even you working with open source models, like, yes, this until specific amount of, let's say the weights, they are free, but then the cost of running them, the inference costs are completely different. That's why for me, I would say it's half-half again.
Okay.
So yeah, for sure, there are a lot of things which now available, but I would really discourage people of thinking that first it has intelligence, mm-hmm. and second that, you know, we done search the wrong way, let's just replace the search, that's the way to go. Because if you look at all the upcoming conferences, talks, it's not about how I optimize and reduce the size of a Docker container or how I, you know, like optimize the inference. It's more about, oh, we get with this model and that model, you know, but not about what are the real cost of running it. And what's going to happen, for example, if one day OpenAI goes down, like how many startups will fall, you know, so sorry, consultant answer.
Speaking of AI and, you know, how does it have any impact on the data mesh? I mean, coming back to our topic of data mesh, does it have any relationship or any impact, or is it just like, hey, AI is, you know, just another use case, another project. You got to be applying the same kind of logical thinking about why you're doing something. You know, is it like that?
I would say you still can somehow put, so you would say, for example, if you have the data mesh in place, which is working, or if you have the most mission critical things as a part of the mesh available for the rest to consume, then it will unlock a lot of unique Gen AI or other type of use cases. So it's more like this. I'm looking at that from the, let's say, consumption perspective. So where basically you have the data served to you, and then you can consume from this qualitative data, and then the results would be better. Evaluation would be easier, and the rest of the things would be better. So I would link it this way. From another perspective, it's also probably, it could be also on the, let's say, input part, whether you have an opportunity to discover new things and then create, let's say, the ideas for potential new data products, which could become a part of the mesh. But I would say for me, 80% would be consumption side and 20% for like this. Although the whole idea of data mesh was like to make data discoverable.
Right, yeah. Right. I also love that you love the Pareto principle, by the way. We're a little bit over on time. We're a couple minutes over. Una, it's been amazing having you here as a guest. One of our favorite topics. Anything you'd like to leave the audience with as a last thought before we close the session today?
Oof. I would say, you know, always ask yourself, what does data flow going to deliver?
I love that.
Why are we doing this?
Yeah. I think that's a great question to not just ask once, but ask constantly throughout the entire life of a project and every other project that you're implementing, regardless of if you're taking a data mesh approach or not. It's just an important thing to do. So amazing. Thanks, Una. Thank you so much. Have a good evening out in Amsterdam. I hope it's a great night, and I hope the cat's doing awesome as well. It was excellent to have you on. So thanks again, and thanks everybody for tuning in. There's a bunch of great comments in the section here. We'll do our best to respond back. I saw, Mark, you had a long share there on some architecture framework around data mesh. So thanks for hopping on as well. So thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time.